May Brussel in Carmel, California. This is side 351, tape number 351, September the 1st, 1978. I want to continue on this side of the tape talking about the testimony of James Earl Ray before the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigating the murder of Martin Luther King. Public hearings that were on television, national television, the week of August the 16th, 17th, and 18th, 1978. For parts that are left out of the House Select Committee investigation, those of you that don't have my tape number 294, that was November the 6th, 1977, I have a tape on Robert Watson regarding the Martin Luther King assassination and alleging that the syndicate and coin operators and gun runners, narcotics operators, were involved in the assassination of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. Robert Watson was a witness to some of this, and he's in a federal penitentiary. And if all goes well, and if he keeps quiet, I guess, and behaves himself, he'll be out in the spring of this next year. But you can get copies of an article written by David Wemple. I think I should be able to copy them for you. I haven't done it. And I'll get his address maybe for next week. And you can get this long article upon which this broadcast was based that I did on the Martin Luther King assassination. For those of you who take the tapes regularly and for new people that subscribe, get along with it after a month goes by or in the future and they're listening to these tapes, some of you may or may not know the running controversy that I've had with Mark Lane, the investigator, who's now the attorney for James Earl Ray. And I want to comment a little bit about Mark Lane's behavior at these hearings and a few things that I observed to illustrate the complaint that I have against Mark. You can get the past tapes. They're itemized and listed if you want them with comments about him. But specifically in terms of these hearings, he did play an important role in showing how the committee worked. I thought that in some ways he was very good. A lot of people thought he was offensive in his manner. He has an Emil Zola complex, the attorney that freed Ralph Dreyfus in France, and he keeps saying, the American people won't stand for this, the American people won't stand, as if he is the sole defender of our civil liberties and rights, and I noted every time he said that. He continuously accused the committee of a lot of connivance. And even on national television, they were doing many things that the Warren Commission did. And I think it was very useful that Lane was able to illustrate them as they went along. And in some ways, he was letting his client down terribly, or as you say crudely, he's simply screwing him against the wall. And in other ways, he gives the appearance of being very angry and distraught with the committee. He argued first about their withholding all the evidence, the written notes that James Earl Ray had given William Bradford Huey 6 and 7 years ago, and yet they wanted to remember every single name of every motel and incident 10 years later, which is an impossibility. I know I stayed in 2 or 3 different motels on my 2-week vacation to Canada, and if I had to give sworn testimony or even were hypnotized, I don't think I could remember the names of the places with the exception of one, because we'd stayed there a few years before. And I made a point of remembering it. I can't tell you where I stayed, and certainly I don't think it would be useful 10 years from now. So Mark Lane wanted this information and had a struggle with the committee to get it. He also challenged what was known as the Garner document. They were presenting information that was unsigned and no proof that this party saw it, and they presented this to the committee to challenge James Earl Ray. They had statements of a Mr. Woods regarding the selling of ammunition. This took place 10 years later, and James Earl Ray and Mark Lane didn't have the documents in front of them. They showed a newspaper that was printed in Los Angeles that said that Reverend Martin Luther King was going back to Atlanta and that he would have these marches. And it was a little piece of paper, undated, no page number, no date. And the suggestion was that as soon as the newspaper came out in Los Angeles, that James Earl Ray could have read it and therefore decided to change his address and go to Atlanta, Georgia. And Mark Lane was very useful in showing that James Earl Ray asked for post office change of address to Atlanta, Georgia, on a given date, and the newspaper they were citing was published the day after he had applied for a change of address. And furthermore, he had testified that when he saw Raul in Mexico, in December, Raul said, be in New Orleans, come back east in March. So the decision was made in December that he would be back there in March, and it wasn't made after he read a newspaper. Yet the committee has been spending millions of dollars on this kind of nonsense, and Mark Lane was very useful in showing the way they turned dates around to try to nail James Earl Ray on public television as following Martin Luther King through the newspaper and then picking up roots and stalking him, so to speak. They also used a witness, Martin Eist from London, a policeman with the London police, 26, 28 years, who was arrested, charged with perjury, removed from the police department, involved with some jewel robberies, was a known perjurer, and yet this committee went to London and sent an investigator and took his recalling what James Earl Ray said 10 years ago and using that before the committee as a so-called bombshell to nail James Earl Ray without giving the criminal background of the person who was charging James Earl Ray with admitting that he killed Martin Luther King. Mark Lane noticed another document that they gave James Earl Ray that was doctored, and he asked them to review it, and he accused the committee of being unfair and using falsified documents to confuse and discredit the witness. They also presented an interview that Dan Rather made with James Earl Ray, and they presented only a few pages for confirmation of the contents in it and not the entire report, which James Earl Ray was promised and never received. And Mark Lane was pretty much on his toes in watching the committee. He was, as I say, obnoxious to some. If he were an honest person, I could stand the being obnoxious. I'm telling you the good things about his presentation, or what I thought was fair, before I get to the really bad. He also challenged one other document that was fraudulent and said it was presented to the news media so that the world would see that James Earl Ray was being discredited by this document. And Mr. Pryor, I believe, or Mr. Stokes said, well, they'll have a chance to read it later in the printed page and they can judge for themselves. It doesn't really work that way. I have some testimony of the Senate Select Committee and different congressional investigations, and, of course, the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission report. But very few people buy from a government printing office. There's one in Washington, one on Golden Gate in San Francisco. My catalogs from the government printing office never have this kind of testimony, or hardly ever. It just has a list of a lot of trivia you can send for. So it's hard to see the printed word and compare it and know what's true. And they tried to admit a lot of things that cast aspersions against James Earl Ray and would confuse the listener, because their first image set on the media is the one that really stays in their mind. The committee acted as if they were really trying to find witnesses who would know that James Earl Ray and Raul were together, that Raul wasn't a figment of the imagination of James Earl Ray. But James Earl Ray said that they knew that they were doing illegal things. He mentioned 30 or 40 of them. And outside of gun running and narcotic smuggling, we don't know what the other 28 were, but he knew they were doing illegal activity. And it's very seldom that two criminals sit in public places where they go around identifying and introducing themselves. They take places that are empty, or they meet surreptitiously, and it's very hard to make yourself public if you know that you're doing something illegal, both of you. I know that when you were in a restaurant or a public place, if I was on a ferry going over to Canada, or in restaurants or bus stations or public parks, I'm sure that somewhere along the route in the past year, I have been in the company of two people having a discussion about some illegal act, whether in a crowded restaurant or a small place. I'm sure you have too. But the fact that these acts take place later, or if one of them is involved in a murder, or one of them is framed, or kidnapping, or gun running, or narcotic smuggling, we would never recognize these people. I'm sure that they go to shopping centers like anybody else and go to the Safeway and buy their groceries and go about their business and go to the post office and pick up mail. After a crime is committed, we sometimes get a picture, but there is no picture of Raul. That doesn't mean that he doesn't exist. It means that James Earl Ray and he never went together to public places and introduced each other as Mr. Eric Gault and Mr. Rowell. There was no reason for James Earl Ray to open a vault and a bank account in Birmingham. He never explained what he did that for. But the committee kept stressing and implying if there was no Rowell, then it must be a figment of James Earl Ray's mind. And then they kept looking for witnesses, some witness that would see him at the time of the shooting. If he wasn't in the bathroom of the rooming house shooting Martin Luther King, who would be a witness for James Earl Ray? Well, an article came out that several parties, it was in the National Enquirer, were witnesses that they were with James Earl Ray, and one of them was a Mr. Wilson. And he said that he saw Ray at a service station. This was in the National Enquirer. And the questioning came from Mr. Edgar from Pennsylvania on the House Select Committee. And he asked James Earl Ray about this Mr. Wilson, and he referred to an article that was in the National Enquirer about Mr. Wilson, and he implied that Mark Lane got his information from the National Enquirer. And Mark Lane got simply furious, and he said, no, I didn't. He said, I interviewed Mr. Wilson in the hospital. Mr. Wilson died. He died just a few weeks before the House Select Committee investigation. He's a man that would have substantiated James Earl Ray's story. And they said, I went to the hospital, and Wilson is dead and can't verify James Earl Ray's story. And he said, I don't get my information from the National Enquirer. I go directly for the person. I didn't refer to the article. They said that he referred to an article. Lane said, I didn't refer to an article. I saw these two men personally. I taped them, and I interviewed them. And I never said anything about a newspaper or those two men, one of them, Mr. Wilson, who's now dead. And he said, the paper also refers to Grace Walden. You remember her. It refers to her. Now, here is a point, and I'm going really slowly on this, and it's important. Grace Walden, who also went by the name of Grace Stevens, was living with a man who owned the rooming house on 422 and a half South Main Street. He didn't own it. I'm sorry, he shared a room there. Charles Quitman Stevens occupied two rooms in the rooming house, at the same rooming house where James Earl Ray checked in. And at the time that Martin Luther King was killed, Mr. Stevens was the sole witness, and his common-law wife, Grace Stevens, Grace Walden, was at the rooming house also. And he turned out to be the only single witness who said that he could identify the person who left the room, the bathroom, and went out of there. He heard a shot. A man ran out, and he would identify him. The trouble was that he was picked up that same day. He was drunk. He was so drunk that he was not believable, even the day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. But Stevens was the key, according to Harold Weisberg, of explaining, this is in quotes, the unending official violations of the law and suppressions of the real story, why none of the evidence in the transcript will ever be made available to anybody. For what Stevens was persuaded to swear was that if there were a trial and he were cross-examined, he would say that James Earl Ray was the person who left this rooming house. Now, he was shown a picture by the FBI of a Mr. Gault's identification picture, and he said, according to the New York Post, the photograph doesn't register. Unless he was wearing a wig or had a facelift or something, it's not the man I saw. The hair is too full, the face is too young, but he described the fleeing man as having long hair. And Stevens was living in this rooming house with Grace Walden. That's the Grace Walden that Mark Lane refers to, while his client, James Earl Ray, is before national television with a House Select Committee on Assassination. They've spent $3 to $4 million already. His client is trying to show that he didn't kill Martin Luther King. And they're fishing for some witness that will show where James Earl Ray was at the time of the murder. But just as important as to show where James Earl Ray is to show that the person who left the rooming house was not James Earl Ray. Now, Grace Walden was living in that rooming house, and she lived with Mr. Stevens, and she said that the person that she saw there was not James Earl Ray. And while he was taken by the police department and taken on a vacation into an air-conditioned fine place and wined and dined, she was incarcerated into a mental hospital where she was kept until this year. And she was locked up because her identification was different from what the official story was of James Earl Ray being in the bathroom. Now, after 10 years, Mark Lane went to the hospital where Grace Walden Stevens was confined. And he has a lawsuit against the government for false confinement of Grace Walden because it's his allegation that she recognized a person other than James Earl Ray leaving the rooming house and occupying the rooming house. Now, Mark Lane referred to her before the committee that her name was in the National Enquirer article. And yet, when he was screaming and yelling about the American people won't stand for this and won't stand for that, I don't know why the testimony or the affidavit of Grace Walden was not presented to soften the story that James Earl Ray was presenting. It would back up what he was saying. They could have asked him if he, in fact, had seen her, if she had seen him, if he had seen anybody by the name of Mr. Stevens. The question always was to prove that James Earl Ray was guilty. No matter who was asking the questions, that was a line of reasoning. And yet, Mark Lane was sitting there and didn't introduce the idea that there were people who could confirm it was not Ray in the rooming house. As James Earl Ray said, if I were going to shoot Martin Luther King, I wouldn't leave my fingerprints on the rifle and leave it right there for everyone to see. I could have used, he said, mayonnaise on my hands or Band-Aids. Also, buying binoculars to look over makes him look twice as guilty as just having a rifle with a scope. And I'm sure as instructed, he said, Raoul told me to buy binoculars because in the time it would take Martin Luther King to leave a motel room to go out to dinner at 6 o'clock, if you're going to stand there looking with binoculars, you're not going to have time to put them down and get out your rifle, and the rifle had a scope. So the binoculars are not of much use, and they were superfluous, but another instrument with fingerprints to make James Earl Ray look guilty. Clyde Watts, the attorney that James Earl Ray referred to, he called the late Clyde Watts, is dead, and it seems that Mr. Wilson, the important witness that could have supported James Earl Ray's story, died just 2 weeks before the House Select Committee got their story going. Congressman Stokes said, now that car with the name Rosen, what would that tell us about Raoul? I talked about on the other side of this tape, on tape 350. And he says, what's that got to do with Raoul? And James Earl Ray says, well, after I found out his correct name was Rosenson, then I went out and got the transcript to an attorney in Memphis, an attorney by the name of Merchant J. Ryan. And he went down and got the transcript from the Fifth Circuit Archives. And I threw it away because the only thing I wanted to know was the fact that Rosenson was a pauper, but that he had three or four expensive attorneys from New Orleans. And later on, Mr. Ryan told me that Mr. Rosenson was an FBI informer. So I think things like that should have been looked into. And I don't know if there ever was or not. Now, this name of Rosenson was in James Earl Ray's car, as I said. But what is he talking about? An attorney by the name of Ryan in Memphis, Tennessee, and the Fifth Court Archives. Where did he get these court records? Where did he find out that the name of the man's car, that party that was in his car, was an FBI person? The committee didn't answer any of those questions. They have absolutely no intention of going into any of the conspiratorial aspects of this, and he left it open, and James Earl Ray said, well, I think it's interesting that this card was in my car. And Mr. Stokes says, well, what does that have to do with Raoul? And Ray said, well, possibly Raoul dropped that card in my car, the name of this FBI informer from New Orleans. I found it down in the gearbox in my seat, and I think you should investigate it and see if there's any connection of Mr. Rosenson to the man who used the alias Raoul, who also was from New Orleans. And Mr. Stokes says, are you saying that Randy Rosenson could possibly be Raoul? And James Earl Ray said, no, I saw his picture. He is not Rao. But in respect to Rosenstein, possibly the government was trying to frame him, and the government, in courtroom testimony, has made attempts to frame him, and I don't know anything about it. And so he's asking them to look into this, that he's not saying it is the person he knows, but maybe if you found Rosenstein, you'd have another clue to who Rao is, because a lot of this was happening right down in New Orleans. That was the hub of activity for the John Kennedy assassination. And he's saying, look into Rosenstein, and maybe you'll have a clue to the man you call Rao. The committee is abysmally stupid all the way. And I can't believe they played that dumb and become members of the Congress of the United States, but maybe they do. Again, James Earl Ray is talking about Raoul, and he also talks about checking out, doing gun running for them, and then buying a gun and using the name John Willard because he is going to do something not exactly legal. He says something's going on, so I use the name John Willard at the rooming house because something is going on that's not exactly legal. And Stokes says, something not legal going on? You had reference to gun smuggling. Isn't that it? No, that isn't it. He took one single gun out of a case and put it under his bed in a rooming house, and he knew he was a co-conspirator in something because he said he made the phone calls to check what came down, and he said he knew he'd only get 15 years, but they wouldn't have anything to pin on him. A murder is illegal, I think it is, and Stokes doesn't ask the question, was the gun going to be used for murder, or was it used for murder? He says, you had referenced the gun smuggling, and just taking a single gun and putting under a bed in a crummy rooming house like that is hardly gun smuggling, and yet Stokes does not refer, Congressman Stokes, to the fact that a murder took place in that city, in Memphis, Tennessee, just not too many feet away from that window. They all play dumb and spend time asking stupid questions, and I've typed them all up, and they're just sickening, and if you get the transcript, you'll be able to read them. Mark Lane was ranting and raving when the testimony of the Englishman, the cop, is not testimony, but it was an interview in London, was presented, and he started screaming about the credibility of the committee. He said, you knew of this man's background, the one they had quoted. It is the height of irresponsibility to inform the American people of that background. If I didn't receive a phone call from a lawyer, a barrister in London, the American people would not know about the deceit of this committee. Then he said, this is probably the most outrageous thing this committee has ever done. It's outrageous. The American people are watching this. They are judging you. They are not judging anyone else here in this arena. Mark Lane was yelling. Well, I think Mark Lane is the most outrageous thing the committee has ever done. He set up that committee. He told them when they first got started, I will see that kooks and crazies like May Brussel and Penn Jones and Sherman Skolnick never get any questions to you, any information to you. The committee does not answer my letters. They do not answer telephone calls. He set up the ground rules of that committee, and I think the most outrageous thing the committee has ever done was to take orders from people like Mark Lane and get themselves into such a structure that people who have information on the assassination of Martin Luther King could never get to the committee, and now they've used up these millions of dollars, and they're a mockery, and the media will say, we told you. It was a show, a circus. It's a lot of brahu, and these men have worked diligently, and they've come up with no conspiracy. That is the legacy of Mark Lane, not of Mr. Blakey. That is what he did, and I have documents and letters and phone calls to prove it, and he had made up his mind that anything that I specifically have to say can never get to this committee. There was a lot of talk during the hearing of the possibility that James Earl Ray was stalking Martin Luther King, yet it never came out, the subject of the mathematical chances of James Earl Ray even getting to a hotel in Memphis, Tennessee, and having a room with a view of where Reverend Martin Luther King would check in and walk out a balcony at that time of the day. James Earl Ray wasn't in the room all the time. He was out. And it would be impossible to know in a city that size where he's going to stay, what his room number is going to be, and to have any kind of a gunman, much less a bumbler like James Earl Ray, right on the spot. The only people that would know where George Wallace was or where John Kennedy was or Martin Luther King are the FBI and the local police. There were plenty of FBI there to protect, in quotes, Martin Luther King. And these are the people, the security people at the Ambassador Hotel would know what door Robert Kennedy was going out, and the guards would know where he was going. The mathematical chances of James Earl Ray locating in a city a room with a view of Martin Luther King are so minute. If he shot from the street or in a car, or if he read that Martin Luther King was having lunch at the Lorraine Motel, if he were shooting in front of the restaurant, but from a room, assigned room, it's just impossible to know where he is staying and sleeping. That wasn't published anywhere. And to have a view of his room. Now, the police and firemen had a view down below, and somebody down the bushes could have a view of that whole balcony if you had to cross that balcony to come out. The woman who signed the room to Martin Luther King, he was supposed to stay in another motel, and then the plans were changed at the last minute, and the woman who made arrangement for the plans that located him in this particular room died within a week after Martin Luther King. She had a stroke and a heart attack. There were different stories about her death. It's been so long since I read those papers. I think it was within a week or 2 weeks she was dead, the woman that located him in that room. The question is, did anybody call and want to know what his room was? There were a lot of news media people around and so forth. What her contacts were or who she told or what happened, we don't know. But she also died very quickly after he had his hotel accommodations changed. But there's no way that James Earl Ray would have any way to know what room Martin Luther King was in, and to be out there at that bathroom window. It was a public bathroom in the rooming house, just sitting there with a rifle waiting to see. From 6 to 7 o'clock, somebody might have had to go pee, and Martin Luther King might have had a late dinner, and James Earl Ray would be standing there with a rifle. I don't think there's any chance that he would have done it that way. There were certain things on my mind as I listened to the tapes of the TV broadcast and the House Select Committee. I've always believed that James Earl Ray worked with Jerry Ray, closely with Jerry Ray, his brother, who is employed and paid by Mr. Stoner of the States Rights Party, the racist, the Nazi, the anti-Semite in the South. And I believe that Stoner would have the connections to the people that wanted Martin Luther King killed. But there was one thing that came up in these hearings that confuses me, and maybe you can think about it. If James Earl Ray were involved and paid by these many people that put up money to kill Martin Luther King, he would know that after serving a certain amount of time in prison, he'll probably get out, even though he has that 99-year sentence. But a year after Martin Luther King was killed and James Earl Ray had been in jail just his first year, John Ray, his brother, was involved in several bank robberies, and he refers to those, and he said Judge Webster gave him 17 years, and his brother Jerry was also involved in some illegal activities and arrested. And it would seem to me that if James Earl Ray were a patsy and were serving time, that some money would be filtered out to Jerry Ray and John Ray. If they were doing this on their own, they had too much access to falsified documents, passports, aliases, and so forth. But if they were doing it with a group, and even on a need-to-know basis, it would seem to me that some small amount of money would be given to each of them, Jerry Ray and John Ray, and not force the brother into multiple bank robberies and put him in jail for 17 years. If the family was involved, it seems to me that some money trickling to them, even just a couple hundred dollars a month or in a vault or a savings account, would be appropriate or paid in cash that they didn't have to account for. But it seems to me that if the brothers were involved, putting them in jail would cause them to talk to another cellmate and break the chain of connection if there was a conspiracy in the Martin Luther King case. I believe there is, and I always believe that the Ray brothers had a role in it, but sending one brother off or having him forced to be so poor that he's doing bank robberies the year after his brother is arrested for killing Martin Luther King doesn't make sense to me, and I can't figure out why he would be doing that and why he wouldn't pay it off. If I had hired James Earl Ray or promised money to the Ray family, I would take care of these guys along the way so that they don't squeal and don't get punished, because then they could give out information that others might want to learn about in exchange for their future freedom. There were 3 days of testimony of James Earl Ray. If you want the tapes, as I said, on the other side, they are available from the Tape Center. There's a lot of unanswered questions here because I'm just doing 1 hour on James Earl Ray's testimony. But if there are things that you want me to comment on it particularly, telephone me or write me a letter, and I'll incorporate it into tapes in the future. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and I'll be with you next week on September the 8th.